This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. This weekend, hundreds of thousands of folks in the LGBTQ community and allies will party and parade in the name of equality. It's the LA Pride Festival in West Hollywood. It's sure to be a blast, as it has been for the past near five decades. But before this year's party gets started, we want to take you a little farther east, on Santa Monica Boulevard, to Silver Lake.
Eagle LA, it's a Levi Leather biker bar, and has been, you know, previous to Eagle LA, it's been that nature of a bar for many, many, many years. So you walk in, the walls are all black. It's very dark, very dimly lit, kind of seedy. We've been noted as one of the top five dive bars in all of Los Angeles, so we're very proud of that, actually.
Charlie Matula is the co-owner of the Eagle LA. It's a gay bar in Silver Lake. It's right by Sunset Junction. Now, Silver Lake, of course, is a bougie hipster mecca these days, but it was once a center of gay life in Los Angeles. Back in 1967, Silver Lake was ground zero for one of the first U.S. protests over police harassment of the gay community, 2 years before the Stonewall riots. And in the 1970s, it became home to a thriving community of gay men, a.k.a. leather daddies, butch guys in boots and leather vests, S&M gear such as collars and restraints. Charlie Matua is something of an elder statesman to this scene. And in honor of L.A.'s biggest gay pride celebration this weekend, we're headed out now to the Eagle with reporter Courtney Kosak.
Charlie's right. The Eagle is a charming neighborhood watering hole, but it's not your grandma's dive bar. For starters, there's gay porn on every screen in the place.
We call them art films.
That's Charlie's husband, Hunter Fox.
Yeah, we definitely have porn playing. There was a time when people just wouldn't come in for that alone because they just thought it was so inappropriate and wrong. And now it's just part of the kind of the culture and the acceptance of people's cultures and who we are and what we do is part of the mainstream. And so it's not so shock and awe anymore.
We have the sexiest staff in all of Los Angeles, I think.
What are they usually wearing?
Not much.
Yeah, not much. That's the best way to describe it. They wear their jock straps and their harnesses and they're shirtless and they're a lot of fun.
A night at the Eagle is about having fun for the guys in the leather scene. But bars in the past were more than just hangouts. They were truly important places for the gay community. They were one of the only safe spaces for people to meet. And they weren't even always that safe. Hunter Fox remembers how just 10 years ago.
We still had men who would come there on their motorcycles who were in their 80s, 70s and 80s, old guys, older guys. And they were part of that history when it was illegal to be openly gay in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was the first city in the country that had anti-gay laws. In 1903, the law was passed that no more than two known homosexuals can occupy a public space. It was considered lewd and indecent conduct, so they would be arrested. So up until the 70s, when they took that law off the books, bars like the Eagle, they never had signs. They just had an address. And they were usually painted very discreetly so they didn't draw attention. And vice would go in anywhere from six or more officers, and all someone had to do was touch someone. And everyone in the establishment were arrested and put in jail.
It wasn't long after those days, the early 80s, when the Eagle Leather Bar first opened in Los Angeles. There are lots of bars called the Eagle all over the country that cater to the same scene. They're not franchises. The name just signals to the community what kind of vibe you can expect to find inside.
The basis of an Eagle is that it's a Levi leather jeans and t-shirt, low-key, not super fancy, just laid back kind of place.
Yeah, almost every major city throughout the United States has an Eagle, but they're not connected in any way other than just like-minded clientele. So, you know, whether it be here, Chicago, Houston, New York, what have you, if you know there's an Eagle, you know what you're going to get. So there's a lot of brand equity in the name Eagle, and it's a great thing to be a part of.
The original L.A. location closed in 1995, and there wasn't another one until Charlie reopened this bar as an Eagle a decade later. He didn't publicize what kind of gay bar this place would be, but people expected something for the leather community. The spot had been part of a long tradition of leather bars starting in 1968. The grand opening was on April Fool's Day.
Not being able to pass up a great opportunity for the best April Fool's joke ever. We created all this marketing, and because people didn't know what was coming, we created all this marketing calling it Silver Lake's newest icky boy bar. We made a poster with Clay Aiken on it, and it was all pink and bubbly, and it was supposed to be this West Hollywood kind of sissy boy bar. And we put out posters, ads, and email blasts, and the community just went ballistic.
It was called Club Cupcake.
Club Cupcake. So build me up, oh, buttercup, don't break my heart. We had hate mail, people, you know, how dare you? It's been a leather institution for so many years. Who the hell do you think you are? And we're just April Fools. And yeah, so some people got it, they laughed, but, oh, that was awesome. And there are other people that were offended because we got them, and they're like, so that's not funny. Take us off your mailing list.
But they came around, right? Because
they did. They did. It actually started a fun little club that we did once a year. So every night on the night of Los Angeles Mr. Leather, wherever that contest is taking place, we did the Mr. Club Cupcake contest. So it was quite interesting to see the men that ran for Club Cupcake.
It was a great laugh.
The Eagle is still thriving, even as hooking up has moved online.
Yeah, prior to the internet and the dating app, the bars were where people go out to meet other people. And now they can just order out like you're ordering food online, basically. And it's really diminished the traffic through the bars and clubs, which is why we are so event and promoter driven now. But oftentimes we'll see people in the bar, you know, on their phones, on Growler or what's the other...
Growler, Grinder, Scruff.
Scruff, yeah. And they're actually talking to someone across the bar.
Someone across the room, that's so funny.
Well, because you can see how many feet away they are from you.
These days, people look to their phones for love. But Hunter and Charlie are old school. So how did you meet?
I was afraid you were going to ask this question. We met at the bar.
We did.
We met probably about 15 years ago.
It was actually before we bought the bar.
Yeah.
And he was actually dating one of my bartenders.
We weren't dating.
They were dating.
Or whatever.
It was a lot of whatever. A lot of fun whatever.
Yeah, he was whatevering with one of my bartenders. And he'd come and sit at his station and visit with him all night. And I got to meet him that way. And we just kind of connected. We just had this energy and connection, and I just sat there all night, and I just, you know, I knew when that bartender was scheduled next that he would come in, so I'd get all excited and wait for him.
While Hunter and Charlie were still getting to know each other, Hunter suddenly stopped showing up at Charlie's bar in the evenings. Charlie didn't know why. It turned out Hunter was in serious trouble.
I had a massive stroke and spent about 20-some days in ICU. I lost my whole right side, and all I kept thinking about was Charlie. And I actually picked up the phone one day and I called him. I didn't drink at the time, so all he heard was me slurring and unable to get words out. And he's like, you know, are you drunk? Do you need help? I'm like, I'm not drunk. I'm in the hospital.
And I was just like, oh dear God. And I just thought, here, this man in the hospital can barely talk. He's dying and he's wanting to see me. His final wish is for me to come see him. And so I rushed to the hospital, and I've never left his side since.
We've had maybe 4 days apart since then.
They've been married for 11 years now. Besides the Eagle, they co-own a restaurant just down the street. It's called Hunter and Charlie's. In all their endeavors, they support the gay community, and especially the leather fetish scene, by holding fundraisers at the bar for a variety of causes. Happy Pride to Charlie and Hunter and all the other revelers flooding the streets of West Hollywood and beyond for this weekend's Pride Festival. For KCRW, I'm Courtney Kosak. Hey, 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 hey. Macho, macho, macho man, yeah. I've got to be a macho man. I've got to be a macho.
Well, Hunter and Charlie are still going strong at the Eagle, but at some point they're going to think about retirement, slowing down just a little bit. The number of gay retirees nationwide is expected to more than double in the next decade. And regardless of sexual preference, it's hard getting old. You have to worry about who's going to care for you, how much money you've amassed over the years, losing your spouse or your partner, dealing with loneliness. But gay and trans seniors have it even harder than straight seniors, according to certified financial planner David Ray, who wrote a piece about it in Forbes magazine. And David is here with us right now. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In your piece, you wrote that much of a generation that would be retiring today was lost to the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. How did that awful time, do you think, David, affect people who are at retirement age right now?
There's two main ways I think it really affected people. I think first off, there's a whole generation of people who thought they may not be alive. You know, they're not going to make it to 65. So they didn't save for retirement. Or if they were unfortunate enough to come down with HIV or AIDS, they probably spent their life savings. They're probably trying to treat it, or they just lived their best life. And then also we lost a generation of seeing people retire ahead of us, to see an example of what we should be doing, what we should be saving, how we should be spending our money or not spending our money, so that we could have a secure retirement as we get older.
The title of your story, the headline caught me when I was reading it the other day, is "Will Retirees End Up Back in the Closet?"
Absolutely.
And I wonder, it's like, because as gay men and women, it's very hard to be in the closet. You come out through the course, and you pretty much come out every day, right?
Yes.
You're telling people who you are, and then all of a sudden you're retiring, and you start to have to hide again? Is that what's going on?
It's happening even here in L.A. I have a client who lives in a senior community here in Los Angeles, so, you know, we're not exactly backwoods here. And I went and saw him, and he literally pointed out the people that on the staff that were knew that he was gay. And I do know for other clients, it's a concern of where they should be living when they retire. Can they get health care when they retire? But as people age, they're going a little bit back in the closet, and they maybe don't want to fight the fight again of fighting for their rights or being out and proud if they don't see really the benefit at 70 or 80 or 90 years old.
Well, and it seems, I mean, you get this idea that as you get older, you get a little more conservative,
yes,
right? And so if you're surrounded by other people who are older as well, ergo, you have that kind of issue.
Yeah, and we've seen this wave of gay rights coming out and gay visibility, but a lot of that is on the younger generations, and a lot more of it is a different mindset for someone that's in their 20s now versus someone that's in their 70s or 80s. They just grew up differently, and how they thought about it and how they've been treated over their life. And I think a lot of people that are retired now or coming up on retirement still have battle wounds from discrimination or homophobia or just self-hate from dealing with their own sexuality over the years.
Or some of whom haven't come out at all.
There is some of that still.
you write that seniors in the LGBT community are more at risk of falling into poverty as they get older than straight seniors. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a combination of things, but I think a lot of people in the gay community, we have this myth of affluence, and we think all gay men are rich, or, you know, the power lesbians running around the Eagle and buying drinks and shots and all that good stuff. But you have people at the bottom.
I don't know about the power lesbians at the Eagle, but take your point. Yeah.
It's not my go-to bar, we'll leave it at that. I'm not there yet. But we have a lot of people at the bottom rungs of society as well. You have, especially in the trans community, or you have people that maybe have been thrown out of their house at a young age. They're just behind the curve when it comes to education and career paths. So they've had to work a little harder, or they've chosen different jobs, or they live in more expensive cities, which can really drain your savings over time.
Let's talk about, I think, one big difference between the gay community and the straight community is children, right?
Yes.
A lot of gay people can have children. Obviously, they find creative ways
Absolutely.
Of having children, adoption, surrogacy, things like that. But a lot of gay couples don't have children.
Yeah.
And when you don't have children, then you lose that opportunity for your child to take care of you.
Yes. And I don't think anyone's having a child planning for them to take care of them in their old age.
But yeah,
I think there is a major amount of care that comes from having a child. Just little things like just watching out for mom or dad is a major help to them when they're retired. Not having that means you're paying for those things, or you're paying for an Uber to get to the doctor, whereas, you know, a child or a family member might have taken you. You're paying for just someone to check on you. There's a lot of extra care that goes into it. And a lot of times you're more likely to fall victim to a scam or be lonely or all those other fun things that come up when you don't have as much of a family unit as you might otherwise.
Let's talk about that loneliness, because that's another thing. If you don't have children, you don't have a large family. You might have a community of friends, which I think is great in the gay community. There's a lot of that. But when you don't have like a family, immediate family, extended family, there is a lot of loneliness. So how does that play into what happens and perhaps even pushing people back in the closet?
You know, I think loneliness is a factor for many retirees, especially people who are not coupled off or don't have the immediate family there. There are way more people that are single in the gay community that are retired than their heterosexual counterparts, which just does play into loneliness. And we think of this gay community and we think of Pride and we think we all have these glamorous lives with friends, but that's not the case for everyone. And, you know, if we bring it back to HIV and AIDS, a lot of people had friends that have maybe not made it this long or not made it to retirement. So there are a lot of people who are finding themselves alone. I passed like 5 billboards on the way over here, but park benches to end LGBTQ plus suicide, which is also a huge issue in our community, unfortunately.
So we've touched on the problems, the issues, right, for people who are getting older in the gay community, LGBTQ community. What are the solutions? I mean, if you're a gay senior living in L.A. and you want to live in a retirement facility, say, that caters to LGBT seniors, what's out there?
There's a few things. I think like the Gay and Lesbian Center is opening a new senior facility for low income, but that's, you know, like 100 units. So that's not going to solve the problem for a lot of people. I think I really like the idea of kind of a Golden Girls living. If you can find friends, I would just love to find 3 other amazing friends. Probably not my mom, you know, so we're not going to have Sophia there, but I would just love to find a way to have a neighborhood or find a condo building where, you know, 3 or 4 of my friends buy condos, even if we're not living in the same unit. But we're just someone's across the hall. So you have that friend that's always there. I think that would be a great way. And it also would save a huge amount of money if you were having a roommate. I'm not dreaming of having a roommate in my golden years from that perspective of like, ooh, roommates, like picturing college and bunk beds. But if you're thinking you're saving all this money or having someone there to watch out for you, and you could watch out for them as well, it could just be a nice way to hopefully help with the loneliness. I mean, I'd like to think that if you're living with someone, you'd be less lonely.
What advice would you give, David, to any person in the LGBTQ community who is nearing retirement or who wants to think about retirement going forward? Obviously saving, but then beyond that.
Yeah, it's beyond money, because money is just one piece of retirement. And I think most of us never want to admit that we're getting old. We're never going to be old enough to retire. I hate to say it, but we will be someday.
It's coming for all of us, David.
But plan ahead. You know, look for where you want to live, what you want to be doing, and who you want to spend your retirement with, because it's not just about the money. That obviously helps make the transition a little bit easier, but it's really about how you're going to spend your days. And look for ways that you still have activities. I know a lot of us spend a ton of time at work, and when you take that away, what are you going to do all day so that you're not just sitting at home staring at a television screen for 14 hours a day?
David Ray, certified financial planner. David, happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Coming up, in the wake of a Mexican heavyweight stunner, what's next for Andy Ruiz in the boxing ring? You're listening to Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. There is a new heavyweight boxing champion of the world, and his name is Andy Ruiz. He won the title last weekend by beating British boxer Anthony Joshua.
And Andy Ruiz has shocked the world. The Mexican Rocky indeed. Incredible!
Ruiz is from Imperial, California. That's a small town between the Salton Sea and the Mexican border. And to hear him talk about it, he has always been a heavyweight.
I was 6 years old when I first went into a gym. And my first amateur fight, I was 7 years old. My dad took me to go fight in San Diego. I was this big, heavy kid. Nobody was in my weight at that age, so I had to fight 12-year-old, 13-year-old. When I was 7 years old, and what do you know? I was beating them. It was crazy.
That was Ruiz on Jimmy Kimmel here in Hollywood just a couple of days ago. Daniel Hernandez is the editor of LA Taco, and he joins me right now. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Steve.
So I'm looking at the LA Times. This is Sunday's LA Times. And it says, Ruiz stuns the world with power to his people.
Yep.
Tell us about this fight on Saturday. I mean, it was a real Rocky Balboa moment, wasn't it?
It was a complete stunner. He was, 11-1 odds or something like that. No one expected this to happen. So it was just going to be kind of a typical Saturday night fight in the boxing community. And then lo and behold, this guy comes in and just knocks out this incredible fighter, we got to say. And so it really was a big moment, I think, for Mexican-American people, Latino people in the United States.
I saw the comparison between the two, and I was like, oh, no. Seriously, it was like, how is he going to, because, I mean, the boxing ring is, obviously, it's strength, but it's also speed.
Right.
Yeah.
It makes you remember, I mean, I went to a public high school in the 90s, and so even in middle school, you learn not to mess with the big kids.
Of course.
You know what I'm saying? The fat kids, quote, unquote, would often sort of engage, and then you realize, whoa, you have a lot of weight and power behind you. And I think Andy's victory really served as a reminder that in this world in which everyone's kind of doing CrossFit and this highly regimented training and really focusing on their bodies, you can still be a sort of perfectly structured person and be an incredible athlete and be an incredible fighter and have a lot of power and force. And I think most importantly, heart.
He alluded to it in the Jimmy Kimmel piece, saying that he always sort of punched up, right? He was always above his class or whatever, even as a kid. How did he even get into this fight?
Well, right. That's another interesting point. I mean, this is something that we all picked up after really the results of the fight. There was another fighter who was scheduled to fight Anthony Joshua, and then there was a doping case. He had to pull out of the fight. This guy came in as a replacement. Really, this fight was going to be a stepping stone for Joshua to really present himself to the U.S. market, and all of that was really disrupted and thrown into disarray by the results of that fight.
What do you think distinguishes him? Because he is now claiming this title as the first Mexican heavyweight, right?
Yeah, Mexican fighters born on both sides of the border, Julio Cesar Chavez, Oscar De La Hoya, these are welterweight and below kind of fighters. We don't usually associate in the boxing community. And by the way, I grew up in a boxing-loving household. My dad was an amateur fighter in the Central Valley in the 60s and 70s. He's now a trainer. When you know about boxing, a lot of people in the Mexican community do. Our fighters tend to be the small, tight guys who come in quick. And we had never seen a fighter really perform at this level. And on top of that, knock out, the champion. So I think that's why this was so big. And it really was an antidote to the kind of the constant demonizing that is occurring politically in this country towards anything labeled capital M Mexican. You know what I'm saying? And it was a very refreshing news event to happen, to see this kind of fighter, a big fat Mexican guy, basically.
Well, and when you look at, like, it's kind of a David and Goliath moment, right?
Right. I mean, here's a guy who looks like he could be, preparing your sandwich at a fancy sandwich shop, or, maybe being a gym teacher or something, but, not a heavyweight champion. And so I think it's really cool that he's really basking in this glory. And, whatever the boxing machinations happen in the boxing world, I hope that we get to see more of Andy Ruiz in the ring because of kind of that heart and that energy that he brings to it.
He was born here in the United States to Mexican immigrant parents. He fought for the Mexican Olympic team. As we said, he calls himself the first Mexican heavyweight champion. He obviously embodies this cross-cultural, cross-border life that a lot of Mexican immigrants live here in Southern California.
Absolutely. There was a previous interview that I read that he said he actually always represented Mexicali, Chicali, which is what locals call it in that region. Mm-hmm. And I knew exactly what he meant because in my family, we still really represent Tijuana. If you ask us where we're from, we're saying we're Tijuana. We're just kind of like Tijuanenses born on the wrong side of the border, that is to say, on the north side of the border. Yeah. And so when he embodies that kind of a cultural figure or a cultural worldview that I think is becoming more and more common, and the more we see it in the public sphere, I think the better we will get to all understanding one another.
He has to fight Anthony Joshua again, right?
Well, right. You know, there's always a rematch clause, right?
Right, right.
And so, you know, I think right now what I assume is that both camps are in deep negotiations about how to organize and carry out this rematch. You know, Andy also said on Jimmy Kimmel that he, you know, he's going to shape up and blah, blah, blah. I don't think he necessarily has to. I don't even think his fans want him to.
Yeah.
But let's wish him the best.
Another thriller in Manila?
That could be great.
Daniel Hernandez, editor of the website LA Taco. Daniel, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. Next week, you're going to meet someone who operates on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border and a potential schism over gay clergy and rights in the Methodist Church. Both sides of that debate very clearly are right here in Greater L.A. Coming up next, it's story time with a bookworm. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Reg Warner, Christian Bordahl, they all make this show happen. We're online, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's do it again next week. Thanks for being here.